Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Thursday, August 30th, 2018. It's just after 4:30 UTC as we're starting this. I'm Sam Minter. Yvonne Bo is not here today. Bruce is joining us again. Hello, Bruce.
Hello.
It's been a long time since you've been on the show.
It's good to be back, yes. It doesn't seem like it's been long because I've been listening every week, but I've made comments, and I know that it's kind of funny that my comments seem to get an outsized response from you all because you're always making comments at the beginning like, oh, for anyone who is really bothered by all the Trump discussion and the inside
Bruce.
Politics stuff. Yeah. And you mention my name every once in a while. That's the comments like that are for me. And also whenever you start talking about Apple stuff, you also put a disclaimer ahead of that saying anyone is not interested in that because I just made a couple of complaints. but that's one of the things that keeps me listening is because this is kind of like a customized podcast for me because I make a complaint and boy, it gets responded to and you just tailor it right for me.
We chat about it because, you know, because one of the things is, of course, your point of view on things is a little bit different than where Yvonne and I are coming from. And that makes it much more interesting to to have that view and to respond to it. So in any case, Yvonne couldn't make it this week because the only day this week he could record was a day that I'm going to be out of town on vacation, doing an extra long weekend with the family in a place where there's no internet. So that wasn't going to work out. So thank you, Bruce, for stepping up. In terms of agenda, we are just going to go the lightning round model today. So we don't have any three big themes or anything like that. We're just going to alternate between Bruce and I picking a topic, and we'll chat about it for a few minutes until we seem to have petered out on that topic, and then we'll move on to the next one. And we'll do that until we feel like we're done. Sound good?
Sounds great. Yes.
Okay.
It'll be kind of like a semi-lightning round because it's not going to be 2 minutes. It'll be maybe more like five.
Well, yeah. And whenever Yvonne and I try to do lightning rounds lately, we haven't even tried to do the timer. We've failed utterly at that. So we usually, like the last couple times we've done a lightning round, the lightning items have still been 10 or 15 minutes sometimes. So whatever, you know, you can call, like if I'm talking about one of these and you're like, okay, I'm bored now, feel free to chime in and say, okay, let's move on.
Sure.
So,
oh yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, since you're the guest, and we usually have the guests like pick most of the topics when I have a guest co-host on. Why don't you start? What's the first thing you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about just a general comment of what I've seen on about the podcast over the years since I've been listening. And one of the things, this is kind of like a complaint, maybe a criticism, maybe something. I met you when we were involved in the Ron Paul election. It was, I think, the 2012.
I believe it was 2012. And because there wasn't anything interesting going on the Democratic side that year, I attended some of the Republican events. And of the Republicans running, Paul was the most palatable to me. So I was, you know, when we were doing caucusing and stuff, I went in that direction. And that's where you were as well. And so we started to interact on some of that. So,
yep, that was great. And so when I first started listening to your podcast, one of the things I really liked about it is that it was kind of like this discussion between a libertarian-ish host versus a liberal, like more centrist co-host. And
I've moved.
Yes, you have moved, and that is my complaint. Yvonne has been pulling you into the dark side, and I'm sorry to say, he's influenced your opinions, and it's also sad to hear you when you say, "Oh well, that you'll never vote for a Republican because of Trump, because Republicans have elected him." Well,
Let me clarify a couple things. First of all, Yvonne and I have been talking about these things for 24 plus years. Any move in the last 4 or 5 years is not because of Yvonne. It's because of other things that are going on in the world. Sure, I talk to Yvonne about it every week, but he's not the one convincing me because he had the same views for much longer, and we were talking about them the whole time. And, you know, it ties to the not voting Republican again right now. And, you know, forever is a long time. If there are substantial changes, then of course I could consider it again. But basically I view the necessary condition for me to ever consider a Republican again is the complete and total repudiation of everything associated with Donald Trump. And if that happens, then it's a whole new party again. If it returns to being, you know, the party of, you know, the Republican Party as it looked like in the 80s or the 90s, then maybe I would consider it. Even then, I had some problems with the Republicans, but in certain areas. But I considered them a worthy alternative that, you know, needed to be respected and needed to be considered as a possibility. In the current environment, I just don't see that. And even if there are a particular candidate here or there that otherwise I would say, oh, okay, I like this person individually and would consider them, as long as their vote let's say we're talking Congress, as long as their vote organizationally was with the Republicans to support the party as a whole, I couldn't go there.
So that would change maybe after Trump is out.
It might not. I mean, and it would make a determination for me. Like, again, once Trump is gone, whether it's in 1 year, 2 years, or the full like time until the end of 2 terms as president, what I have seen is of elected Republicans, every single one of them, I shouldn't say every single one of them, that's an exaggeration, but of elected Republicans at the national level, there are very few who have seemingly been willing to call Trump out and actually do anything about it. And so at best, I view them as accepting of what he does and what he stands for. And that's not good enough for me. Like, even if I agree on policy issue A, B, or C, they've sort of failed to meet the minimum threshold of decency that I would consider is necessary to even consider them for anything.
Okay. Well, here's a thought. It's yes, people on the left are totally. I really hate to be in the position of defending Trump. because I really don't want to defend him. I would much rather be bashing him. But the thing is that he's being bashed for the wrong things. He's being bashed for things that are either inconsequential or actually good.
Some examples.
For example, he's being bashed for wanting to have a good relationship with Russia. And of all political issues,
I just want to correct you. That's not why he's being bashed about Russia, because George W. Bush and Obama both wanted to have a good relationship with Russia and acted on it and did not get the same sort of treatment. He's being bashed related to Russia because he is not. He's just willing to do anything for that good relationship. He's not. It's not just, hey, we want to have a good relationship.
That's not really the case. Not at all. I mean, he's ejected 50 Russian diplomats. He's bombed the Russian bases in Syria. he's sent weapons to Ukraine.
Every single thing that you just mentioned is something that he has done reluctantly when his staff insisted on it. And even if you agreed with all of that, it's sort of again, he's not being bashed for wanting to have a good relationship with Russia. I think everybody, including his opponents, would prefer to have a good relationship with Russia. What he's being bashed for is sort of the willingness to sort of turn the other way and overlook things and, you know, and when talking about them, sort of being obsequious about it. Again, you know, both of his predecessors spent, and actually you could go back further than that to Bill Clinton or even George H.W. Bush. They all wanted to improve relationships with the Russians, and they all tried to do so, and they all failed, by the way, but they all wanted to move in that direction, and they did not get the same level of criticism. Now, all of them got some criticism, usually from the right, not from the left. So it's interesting that that flipped. But, this is a different order, but it's not about people criticizing him because he wants good relationships with Russia. It's about the way that he wants good relationships with Russia.
Okay. Well, the other thing is, on the show, I want to keep it, someone on this topic is,
okay.
This is a compliment. I really do appreciate how you really do seem to understand libertarians and the way we look at the world. And whenever the topic of libertarian philosophy or any kind of points of view do come up, you do represent my view very well when talking to Yvonne. So I really do appreciate that.
Well, I try. And in many cases, it's because I do agree with that view. In some cases, I used to agree with it and don't really anymore, but I still understand where it's coming from. But I actually think that's somewhat important to try to understand where the other views are coming from. And sometimes I fail, but it's something that I always want to try to, in any debate, if you can't articulate the other person's point of view in a way that they would agree is fair, then you're not really having a debate. You're just yelling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so used to hearing people describe the libertarian point of view, and all they do is they just make a straw man and they make it seem like a ridiculous point of view. But I never hear you say that, so I appreciate that.
Okay. Well, thank you. And so I want to get, I want to rewind a little bit because I wasn't quite done with that Donald Trump stuff. So you mentioned people are criticizing him for the wrong reasons, and Russia was one of those. What else?
Yeah. So so he gets criticized for being insulting to different groups, for being politically incorrect, being very crude. Like this week, he was criticized for not coloring the flag very well when he was in with us elementary school kids. And it's like, really, they're going to criticize him for that and poke fun at him for that. Meanwhile, he's...
Well, that one clearly wasn't a serious one. I mean, come on, it deserves poking fun at, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it does. But yeah, it's just all the things he tweets about, and people are up in arms about how rude he is and about how clueless he seems to be. But on the other hand, he is doing things that are really bad, such as, the Iran deal, having troops in Syria, the Yemeni war. There you go. MSNBC has not done a single report on the Yemen war for the last year.
Almost nobody has. You hear almost nothing about that. And that includes us. That includes us. We have not spoken about the Yemen war. I've read things here and there and blah, 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 but it has not been top of mind. And, it's a bloody disaster.
And that war could not have happened
without our support.
Could not be happening without our support. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just now getting some traction in Congress, where some congressmen are trying to stop it because it's going against the War Powers Act and such. Just because we have some other troops on the ground, we do have. I do believe that it just came out that we do have some special forces on the ground there. But
yeah,
but
I believe that's true. I think I read that a long time ago. But
yeah, we should have no, just like in the Syria war, we should have no dog in that fight because it's bad guys against other bad guys. And but it's so frustrating.
Well, and to me, more to the point in both of these, whether it's bad guys or good guys there, either way, our involvement is doing nothing but prolong it.
Yes.
And so in the end, you know, more people are dying because we're involved, because we're putting in weapons, because we're supporting one side or the other. And, you know, in most of these conflicts, it would be nice. And this is an area where, you know, you could see, like, it would be nice if Russia and the U.S. would cooperate. Like in Syria, the right approach would be both of all of the major parties saying, we're going to embargo the whole area, no weapons allowed in, just let them, you know, make it truly a local thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would still be horrible for a while, but it would probably have ended a long time ago if it didn't have outside forces from both us and Russia and Iran and wherever, all like, you know, sticking in there, sort of prodding the stick and, you know, shaking it up. But
yeah. And there's a whole long list of other things that that Trump is doing that's horrible, but we'll probably mention those in and out throughout the rest of this podcast anyway. So.
And you know, the one thing I would say is, you know, and this is some of the debate I've had with Ed as well, who's another person who co-hosts on the show occasionally, is sort of where do you focus on issues and policy versus the issue versus, you know, the norm breaking, as they call it, that Trump is doing.
Oh, yeah. Here's one thing that people are so up in arms is being insulting to our allies and kind of alienating them, things like that. It's like, I could care less about that.
See,
but that's just
me. Now where I look at on those sorts of things, I think the norm breaking, including that kind of stuff, the being insulting to allies, et cetera, is the kind of stuff that has, you know, the policy stuff to me causes short-term damage. The norm breaking stuff causes long-term damage.
That's true.
That, you know, and so to me, the norm breaking stuff is actually more important in many cases because the policy stuff is more easily reversible. For the most part. Now, obviously, if you've gone and killed a bunch of people in a military attack, you're not bringing them back or anything. I'm not saying that. But for policy stuff, you have a couple elections, you bring new people in, they reverse the policy. You know, and maybe it's the presidential election, maybe it's a bunch of congressional elections, whatever. But, you know, through the normal process of things, if people disagree with what's going on, they elect different people, they will do different things, and you can reverse some of that policy stuff. The norm breaking stuff sort of changes the universe of what is okay to even think about in a way that it seems, you know, can cause damage that will far outlast Trump's time in the presidency because the next guy who comes around will realize they can do that stuff too.
Uh-huh. And you know what? Probably one of the most threatening things to that is the strength of the dollar, that we've been overusing our ability to impose sanctions on different countries, and so many of our allies are so fed up with it, especially when it comes to Iran, because Europe was just beginning to begin those business relationships with Iran. But now the sanctions were removed in 2015, that they now all of a sudden unilaterally. The U.S. can say, nope, we're not going to do business with any European country that does business with Iran. So then what that does is that pushes our allies to form other monetary systems outside of ones that we control. And so then we end up having less of a benefit to the dollar. So the dollar will end up long term being weaker because other currencies will be used for trade versus the way it is now.
Okay.
But that's like going way outside of what we were talking about. That's sort of related, sort of unrelated.
That's quite all right. So I guess it's my turn. So I will continue what I've been doing on recent shows, at least for my first thing, and do movies. And I'll actually do two in one shot because I rewatched The Incredibles, and then I went to see The Incredibles 2 in the theater.
Okay, don't spoil Incredibles 2 for me, man.
Okay.
Because I haven't seen
it yet. You haven't seen it yet? Oh, man.
No, I've been wanting to.
No spoilers. I will say I enjoyed rewatching The Incredibles. I pretty much all of the Pixar movies I like. I haven't found one that I hate yet. Some are better than others, but I enjoy all of them. And The Incredibles was no exception to that. I had fun watching it when I first saw it. I had fun watching it again. It's one of those movies that I actually can watch multiple times and enjoy, although I'm not one to watch, like every month or anything, once every couple of years is fine. I enjoyed that. And The Incredibles 2 is, I think, a worthy sequel. It picks up exactly where the last movie ended. So there's not a time gap in between. It's like, literally.
Which is something you can do with cartoons that you can't do anything else.
That's right. And so, it was also fun. It was a good Pixar movie, without giving any spoilers. I guess the focus moved a little bit from Mr. Incredible to Mrs. Incredible or Elastigirl. The family had an even larger role. It's fun. It's escapism. It's a superhero movie. I don't know that that is that much more to say about it, but it's a fun, enjoyable time. If you enjoy any of the Pixar movies, you should see this one too.
So Sam, you need to have some sort of rating system. You need to do like a thumbs up, thumbs down, 1 to 5 stars, a percentage, like on Rotten Tomatoes.
I will move it to thumbs up, thumbs down only. This is a thumbs up.
Okay.
Or maybe sometimes I would do a thumbs sideways.
Okay.
But any more than those three categories, I think, is actually overthinking it.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, thumbs up for both The Incredibles and The Incredibles 2. Watch them. They're fun.
Cool.
Okay. Well, before we move on, you haven't seen The Incredibles 2, but you have seen the original Incredibles, right?
Yes.
Thoughts?
Yes.
Thoughts on that one?
But I haven't seen it since it came out.
That's a long time.
But I did enjoy it.
2004.
Wow.
So I would say, although not entirely required, if you're going to see Incredibles 2, rewatch Incredibles before you do.
Oh, okay.
It's not required. It's not like you'll miss out on anything big by skipping it. It's just, it's nice to have the background and just see the whole series.
Well, I definitely want to show it with my kids because they were a lot younger, especially, well, at least our youngest, she's only 7, so she'll definitely need to watch the first one.
There you go. Okay, your turn again.
Okay, let's see. All right. So I just listened to last week's show today, and one of the major discussion things was about the Mueller indictments. The Manafort indictments, the Manafort trial and results.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of discussion between you and Ivan about the result and how y'all were puzzled that 10 of the 18 were with a hung jury, and there's one juror who basically, in the face of clear evidence that he was guilty, said that he was innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And based on what y'all said, it was clear to me that the juror was actually the reason was it was because the juror was doing what's called jury nullification. And the idea of jury nullification is that and when you're a juror, you don't have to just judge whether the individual is guilty or innocent. You can also judge on the merits of the law.
Jury nullification goes further than that. It actually says you can use whatever criteria you want, period.
Yes, true. But with regard to it could be. So, but in regard to what I've been learning about it is that especially for libertarians who disagree with the law, and if you happen to be on a jury, you can choose to simply say, innocent, even despite the evidence, if you disagree with the law. Right. And with regard to these laws that he committed or that he broke, the philosophy for me is if there's no victim, there's no crime. And there were no victims in at least the crimes that he was being tried on here.
So, but the reason, like, and first of all, I'll say I've actually always loved the idea of jury nullification. I like the idea. I think that the whole notion that, you know, in the end, if you're in that jury room, you can you don't have to follow the judge's instructions. You don't have mm-hmm. to pay attention to the letter of the law. It doesn't have to be based on the facts even. It can be like, hey, this guy, I don't believe this law is just, like you were talking about. Or maybe the law is just, but in this case, for this person, I think it was justified, and I'm going to mm-hmm. vote innocent because of that. Or any number of reasons why you may choose to vote innocent. I like that concept. And if I was ever in such a jury situation, I might well vote that way if I felt compelled to by the case in front of me. Yeah. However, in this case, the reason it didn't come to mind is the inconsistency. Like, if they in fact were voting, like the one place where that could buy is the conspiracy ones, because they mm-hmm. consistently, they voted innocent on all of the conspiracy ones. And so maybe, okay, I could see that, like them saying, okay, the other stuff, fine, but this conspiracy one, it doesn't make any sense to me. I don't think that's whatever. Or maybe they really did have a fact issue. Like, you know, they proved the guilt on bank fraud, for instance, but they didn't prove to me that he was conspiring with others to do that. I don't think that's the case, but maybe, you know, what you're saying there.
Yeah,
but,
I agree. I would think that they would just say no on everything.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So in the bank fraud cases, for instance, where they said guilty when he was defrauding one bank, but innocent when they were defrauding a different bank, that doesn't sound like jury nullification to me. Or when they said guilty for 1 year, but innocent for another year. Because if you objected to the law as a whole, or if you just said, hey, we shouldn't be prosecuting this guy for this stuff, then why wouldn't you do innocent across the board? I mean, they could have hung all 18 counts. The thing, yeah. But they did guilty on 8 and only hung on 10, which makes, that's why, like, jury nullification didn't really spring to mind. Like, if they had in fact hung all 18, then I'd be thinking, oh yeah, something like that. There was something where they just, for whatever reason, whether it was a jury nullification type reason where they objected to the law or they thought it was victimless or whatever, then that would make sense, along with conspiracy theories of like, oh, somebody got to them and blah, 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 is intimidating them. You could think of those, but those only seem to make sense if you do it on all 18. The split is what makes it mystifying.
Well, one thing also to consider is they don't, you know, the jurors can give, can judge on whether guilty or innocent, but they cannot determine how long the sentence is.
Right.
And what happens a lot is when jurors vote guilty and then later on they find out how long the sentence is, then they regret having voted guilty because they're like, whoa, that is way overboard for a punishment. So maybe they were trying to modulate the amount of punishment that he was going to get.
And the thing is, you're right. That might be a motive. It might be a misguided motive, because from what I understand of how the sentencing guidelines for these kinds of things work, the fact that it's 8 counts versus 18 probably won't actually make that much difference in the final sentencing. And and in sentencing, they're actually allowed to take into account some of the things they were acquitted on too, which is kind of bizarre to me and doesn't sound right. But I've heard a number of legal analysts say that, you know, at sentencing, they can take into account everything that was brought up at trial, not just the things they were found guilty of. But in the end, 8 versus 18 might not actually make that much difference in sentencing, but the juror might not have known that. The juror might have been like, hey, this is enough. We don't have to pile on. And
maybe that was it. Well, you know, we'll probably never know, because one thing that everyone should know is the whole idea of journey nullification is a very dangerous idea to the government, and probably one of the most dangerous ideas to the government of all, because if you were to go into a jury room and say, hey, I don't agree with this law, I'm voting innocent, then they'll just kick you off the jury.
Yeah, most of the time. On our Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, one of the participants there, Greg, who's a lawyer, chimed in and said, well, you know, I've heard of people trying this, like, intentionally, in order to get out of jury duty. They'll talk about jury nullification or about how they hate the law. And what generally happens is the judge calls them up to the stand and questions them fairly intensely on the details of what they feel and why they feel it and blah, blah, blah. And most of the time, when subjected to that questioning, the person isn't able to answer coherently. And the judge is like, okay, you're just bullshitting. You can't get out for this. But if somebody actually is well-informed on the topic and has coherent views, they almost certainly would be tossed out. And there's also been cases where, you know, judges have actually gone somewhat nuts in terms of, like, you know, cases where people were standing outside the courtroom handing out pamphlets about jury nullification to potential jurors. And those people got, you know, cited with contempt of court and things like that.
I wanted to mention that, too.
For providing that sort of information. And
that is the one thing that's the one reason why that is such a dangerous. That's one way that to show that that is a very dangerous idea to the government, is because what other information would be so dangerous that handing out a pamphlet is going to get you thrown in jail?
Well,
you think that handing out pamphlets, you could hand out pamphlets on how to make a bomb and they wouldn't throw you in jail.
To be fair, though, if you are handing out pamphlets on all kinds of other details of the law to protect prospective jurors, they don't like that in general, because they, you know, and this is another reason why lawyers usually get tossed out as jurors, and because they don't want anybody knowing too much. They want people coming in as a blank slate who will only know what is presented to them at trial.
Yeah. So that's my only guess as to why I've never been on a jury. I've been continuously registered to vote since I was 18, and I'm 50 now. And I was once called to go in to report as a juror. But then I was like in there for an hour, and then I got dismissed, and I've never gone back.
I've also never actually served on a jury. I've been called a few times and always been sent away, as we don't need anybody today after all. In the old days, I had to actually go in and sit in a room all day before they dismissed me. More recently, of course, they've got organized a bit more so that you can call a phone number and they can tell you don't even bother coming.
And yet I've heard of other people who've go every couple of years, they get called. It's still don't understand the logic of that, but whatever. Anyway.
Okay. I will do one more and then let's take a break. Let me see. What should I pick here? I did an insert on last week's show, so I figure I should just mention it here, even though I don't have a lot to say about, the passing of John McCain. There's been a lot going on. You know, one of the things that I've seen is there's a group of people who are very much sort of like, all this deification of John McCain is insane. He did all kinds of bad things too. Let's talk about those bad things. And I don't disagree with talking about the bad things about John McCain. He certainly had a bunch of things in his history that I disliked as well. And you can certainly blame him for a lot of things that had some negative consequences. But the thing that, and this is sort of that fuzzy tonal stuff that we were talking about when we were talking about Donald Trump. The one thing that I appreciate on John McCain that does seem to be diminishing in our politics is the sort of, you know, recognition of the process is important, and being able to recognize that your opponent still means well, I think is an important thing that, a lot of the stuff that was held up as people were going, you know, oh, look how wonderful a person John McCain was. And sure, it's cherry picking examples, but the examples picked were sort of important ones where he was, you know, reaching across the aisle, recognizing that, you know, his opponent meant well, and that, you know, hey, we all have different ideas about this, but in the end, you know, the voters will decide, and then we'll go about our business, and we'll continue the fight, but it'll be a fight that's sort of, you know, civil, where we talk about the ideas and we debate them, and, you know, the people choose, you know, and I think that's, yeah. You know,
I agree with that too. It's true that he has a really bad record on a lot of different issues. But you know, it's one of those things where when he's just passed away, and you don't speak evil of the dead. And I think especially after they've passed away, give it a few months. Then, if there's ever a debate about, looking over his legacy, then we can bring up things, you know, the horrible things that he's done. But,
I don't want to shy away from them even right after, but I think the people who are completely demonizing him and saying, you know, hey, you know, forget all these nice things that people are saying, like he did this and this and this and this, and those were all really bad. I think that's an incomplete picture too. I mean, the fair thing is to recognize both sides. I also disagree with the people who are, you know, sort of going about it as he was a saint. No, he wasn't a saint.
Yeah.
let's talk about reality in the middle somewhere. And he has a bunch of positive things in his legacy. He has a bunch of negative things in his legacy too. But again, to me, the key is overall seeing him go is like, it's a dying breed of an old type of politician who you don't see very much anymore. And this relates to sort of the polarization of the two parties and how it may have been the aberration sort of in the second half of the 20th century, where you had a long period of time where there actually was a lot of ideological overlap between the parties, and there was a lot of, things that were done by consensus in a bipartisan way. And things have sorted themselves to the point where a lot of that is almost unimaginable today. And I think the trends were already in that direction going back quite a ways, but they were very much accelerated by Donald Trump's win. And I think that as much as I'm very much part of it, I mean, we talked about it at the beginning, I'm never going to vote for a Republican again. I can't even respect them as long as they like Donald Trump. And as much as I'm a part of that problem, I recognize it as a problem. You know, if you have this type of polarization, it makes it all that much harder to actually move things forward in a positive direction, because people are always just angry at each other.
I would like to mention two things just in the realm of praising someone after they've passed away. I will say two things that good about John McCain. First of all, he was always good on torture.
Yeah.
Meaning that having been a victim of torture himself, during the time when we were debating as a country whether or not torture was something that we do, he always spoke clearly and forcefully against what we were doing in Afghanistan and Iraq to those detainees that we had, and including the debate about waterboarding.
Yeah.
There are so many people out there saying, oh, waterboarding's not torture. It's just splashing water in your face. And he would consistently say, no, that is torture. And that is wrong. And that's not something we do as a country unconditionally. And I thought that was good. The other thing is, this is kind of like a deathbed confession, really. But in his book that came out earlier this year, he finally did admit that the Iraq War was a mistake.
Yeah.
So sadly, he never translated that regret or that mistake into current policy, saying, well, if that was a mistake, maybe we shouldn't be doing blah, 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 what we're doing right now. He just would, you know, it's pretty safe right now to look back 15 years in the past and go, oh yeah, that thing we did 15 years ago, maybe we shouldn't have done that. hopefully people will learn from that. And, I think definitely public opinion has turned clearly against the Iraq war, and it is turning now against the Afghan war.
Okay. Well, with that, let's take a break, and we will come back with more topics after this.
AfricaFocus.org features high-quality analysis and progressive advocacy on African issues with a particular attention to priority issues affecting the entire continent. The heart of the website is the Africa Focus Bulletin. Other features include regularly updated Africa-related news feeds and a set of country pages with extensive background and links on each African country. If you follow African issues or are even curious, visit AfricaFocus.org today.
Okay, we are back, and Bruce, it is your turn again.
Okay, let's see. You know, one thing that I miss is that you'll talk about tech very rarely, and
when we have talked about tech, we've generally said, "And it's kind of boring. There's nothing really going on that's all that interesting."
I know. I looked and looked and looked today, and I could not find anything really worth talking. It's like oh, a new phone or a new watch, or this app has a new feature. It's like, who cares? It's like, really going to talk about that? But I did listen to a podcast this week that we could discuss, and that is the what I put into the show topics as the Uberization of everything.
Okay, and plug the podcast. Which podcast were you listening
to? It's the Cato Daily podcast, and it was I don't have the title of it, but I'll I don't know if you have show notes or anything, but I'll send you a link.
Okay. Do. We do have show notes, but they don't typically have links to articles and all that kind of thing. It's just the list of topics in the show and maybe a little description at the top of the whole episode. But Bruce did send me the information on the particular episode he was talking about. So again, the podcast is the Cato Daily Podcast. You can search for that on whatever software you use to listen to podcasts, and I'm sure you will find it. The specific episode that he was talking about was the August 20th, 2018 episode entitled Tomorrow 3.0, Transaction Costs and the Sharing Economy.
It was this week or sometime in the last 7 days on the Cato Daily podcast. It was an economist talking about what's called transaction costs and the fact that technology, and especially when it comes to delivery, the lowering the transaction cost of delivering goods to people, and also when it comes to automation, autonomously delivering goods to people, that will lower transaction costs. And what that will enable is for us to be more renting things rather than buying things. And example that I have for us is the other night I was making I was making a dessert with my wife, and she mentioned, "Wow, we need one of those stand mixers, those big mixers."
Right.
And I was like, "Wow, you never have needed one." But in that case, we really did need one, because I was using a hand mixer for like 20 minutes, just standing there going around and around. It was like getting really boring. And I really would have liked one for that night, but.
But only for that night.
Only for that night. If I were to buy one, it'd be like, what, $400, and it would just sit on the counter for 99% of the time and just take up space. And wouldn't it be better if instead I could go into an app and order a stand mixer, have it delivered by a robot, and arrive like within an hour? I could use it for a day or two and then have it sent right back. And, you know, I'd be willing to pay like $10, $20 for that rather than paying $400 for something that just takes up space. And now you can't do that for everything. You can't do that for like a TV or a bed or whatever. But
But you can certainly do it for some things. And as the, like you said, as the transaction costs of delivery and go down, it becomes more practical. I mean, there are services that have existed along those lines that let you, you know, rent out tools or utilities or whatever. And I've seen a few things describing, you know, sort of pools of equipment at like apartment complexes where like they'll buy one mixer for the whole building or whatever, and you can check it out, you know, things like that. But doing it at scale in, you know, places where you're not all physically right next to each other and can go down to the common room in the apartment and pick something up, is hard right now because, you know, you do have to get it and then you have to send it back and then you have to keep track, like, what if they damaged it? Or what if, you know, it just, you know, they packing it up and shipping it back is a pain in the ass, right? You know, so they have a few problems to solve there, but you can clearly see where that kind of stuff will be easier going forward. And you know, and obviously one of the big examples people have talked about are the self-driving cars themselves. You know, why would you buy a car if you could just order one and have one at your door in 5 minutes, no matter what, you know? Yep. And there are some reasons why you might still want to have one, but most use cases disappear if you have easy at a glance or, you know, on demand access to things. And I could certainly see it for a lot of the, you know, small household things as well. But it is all about the convenience. Like, if I need a wrench because I'm about to go do something, you know, I don't really want to wait, you know, I have like the thing I want to do right now, you know?
It becomes things like you use maybe once a year or twice a year rather than, you know, once a week or,
right.
Or it depends. And also you're seeing that, more with, bikes and scooters. When you go around Seattle, I'm sure you've seen those green bikes just scattered all over the place.
And they have, and of course that's the model there, and they have yet to see, like, most companies doing that so far have failed, but they keep trying. They adjust the model in certain ways to try to make it so that it'll work better this time. But so far, like, all of these bike rentals and scooter rentals and stuff like this, Seattle's seen like four or five companies doing this come and go, you know? And so I have yet to have a lot of confidence of it working out permanently for, you know, the one who's doing it today. But I think eventually the model will work. It's just a question of getting the details and economics right. But I'm not sure we're quite there yet, but it's certainly getting closer as you know.
Just like with any tech, you know, it becomes, it works for a very narrow market. And then as improvements are made, incremental improvements are made, it becomes wider and wider and wider use, and then it becomes dominant. And right. the other implication about this is that if you think about manufacturing and environmental implications of this, when you have factories making, you know, millions of stand mixers, when really in the future, there may only be a need for a few thousand. And
now let me ask, you know, whether maybe the economist in the podcast you were listening to talked about this or not, but there seem like there are significant economic implications to this as well. Obviously, like, if you don't need a million stand mixers and you only need a few thousand, well, the stand mixing companies are going to have an entirely different economic model about what they make and what they don't make. And maybe it's not even worth it to them to make them anymore, or maybe they're going to be much more expensive because if I'm only going to be able to sell 1,000, you know, I have to charge more. And then there's, you know, and that goes on to, you know, the employees in those industries and going back to Uberization per se, you know, Uber drivers make a lot less than taxi cab drivers used to make. Right. You know, and so it seems like there are all kinds of potential snowballing effects of this that we don't yet understand.
Yeah, there's going to be winners and losers, but I think at least it looks like environmentally it'll be a smaller footprint on the planet.
it'll be a more efficient use of resources, hopefully.
Yeah, I think this is one of those cases where environmentally it looks better, and quite possibly for consumers it looks better. I'm not sure what it does on the production side and on the employment side, you know? And obviously all of these things have to balance out somehow. But I think there's a lot of dynamics in the way all these things relate to each other that are just inherently unpredictable until you try them. And also there's, you know, as with all technological developments, you know, the fact that you sort of take one thing off the table sort of seems to always provide room for something else to develop that wasn't even a possibility before as well, that's enabled by this stuff. So,
It's going to be a massive change when these robotic vehicles, as they come out, it's going to be a massive change. And it's got so many implications. It's fun just to think about.
Yeah. I mean, did I hear something like 10% of I'm going to make up the number. Some huge number of people are employed in jobs that involve driving. If you eliminate them entirely, it's a significant chunk of the population that no longer has that as something they can be employed at. That doesn't necessarily mean they have nothing else to replace it. Maybe, maybe not. But it's certainly going to be extremely disruptive if it's allowed to progress.
Yeah, if you were to talk to somebody 100 years ago and tell them that in the coming decades, only 2% of the population would be involved in the agriculture industry, they would be wondering, what are those 98% of the people going to be doing?
Right. Well, and the thing is with those kinds of changes as well, that the change does take time, and sometimes it is generational. So like a bunch of those farmers who lost their jobs didn't necessarily, get gainful employment doing something else, but their kids did.
Yeah.
You know,
they aged out. Whereas now it's so fast that people won't be aging out. They'll just have to go to school again.
Perhaps. Or we'll have to figure out something else.
Yeah. the universal basic income, we'll have to talk about that some other time.
Okay. Okay, so my turn again, and I want to mention a couple things. You talked about 2020 as one of the things you wanted me to talk about. I'm not going to get quite yet into presidential candidates. You can ask me about that as one of your turns. But the Democrats this last week finalized a bunch of changes to their rules for the 2020 cycle. And there were two major changes that came out of this. And this was all part of the negotiation between the Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton folks coming out of 2016. Change number one was a significant reduction in the power of superdelegates. They did not eliminate superdelegates. However, they changed the rules so superdelegates essentially would not have a vote in the first round. So superdelegates would only get to vote for president if there was a second ballot. So
which almost never happens, right?
Which has never happened since we've had the primary systems in place. You know, the last time it happened was when all the delegates were chosen in smoke-filled rooms and we weren't really having elections about these things anyway. So in the modern era, that has not happened at all. So effectively that takes the superdelegates out of the debate for, you know, all this Bernie Hillary tension, was related to, you know, all the Bernie folks saying that superdelegates were unfair and they had to be bound by their states and how could these people have a vote and how undemocratic that was and blah, blah, blah. And you know, I actually think that having the superdelegates there is actually a useful thing. However, you know, in the end, this was given up. I mean, because effectively, now the superdelegates will still be there at the convention. They'll still be able to vote on things like the platform and rules and blah, blah, blah. So they'll still have influence. And because they're important Democrats who have elected office and all kinds of other things, they will undoubtedly have an outsized influence on what happens at the convention no matter what. But the sort of specter of superdelegates overturning the quote unquote will of the people is essentially gone. They will only have that vote if you get to a second ballot. And frankly, if you get to a second ballot, all hell is breaking loose anyway, and there'll be all kinds of chaos, and it would be great fun.
That's actually pretty incredible. That sounds like that's an achievement by the Bernie.
This is something that the Bernie folks pushed really hard for. And what was actually surprising to me is that the Hillary faction of the party didn't really fight that hard against it. They did fight against eliminating the superdelegates entirely, because I guess all those folks wanted to go to the convention and have a party, but they didn't really fight hard against not having that vote. There were other proposals that were talked about earlier before they got to this point about, you know, let's give the superdelegates half votes, or let's have the superdelegates vote, but they have to be bound on the first ballot to vote the way their state voted, and all kinds of other stuff. And I think there even are still some complications where in a certain scenario they have to vote but are bound. That was the case a couple weeks before the final. But anyway, let me not go there. In the end, the result is they don't get to vote on that first ballot, and they apparently didn't care that much about that. They wanted to protect themselves going to the convention. They wanted to protect themselves being able to vote on other issues, but they were willing to give this up, which I found was very interesting. But what they got in return, and I'm not sure for the Bernie folks this is a fair trade, actually, is that they got a much stronger push towards rules on caucuses to make requirements on caucus processes for absentee ballots and all sorts of other factor, and always having counts of at each level of the process, and a number of things, and also just generally pushing a move away from caucuses towards primaries. Something like half of the number of states that had caucuses in 2016 will have caucuses in 2020. There more are being pushed in the direction of primaries. And even in the cases where there are caucuses, there are all kinds of rules being added to make them more accessible. And one of the things about caucuses as they existed previously is they were, by their very nature, because you have to go there, you have to show up, you have to state your vote publicly, you have to go through this whole rigmarole, and you have to be there for hours. It's not just going in and voting and leaving. It biases it towards, you know, people who have a lot of free time, people who don't have to worry about daycare, people whose jobs are flexible enough to allow them to go to the caucus, you know, all of
and
this.
And those who have an intense interest.
Yes. And which is, by its very nature, this is not a representative sample of your party as a whole. It is a sample of, you know, activists who have the time and interest to do this. The rules changes on caucuses don't make them into primaries. They're still a pretty high bar to go to, but they've done a lot to try to make it so that people can participate and less people are excluded from the caucus process. If you're talking Bernie versus Hillary, Bernie was very strong in these caucuses, but fairly weak in primaries. So overall, okay, he got the concession on superdelegates, which in the end did not really make any difference whatsoever. They made some psychological difference, and I guess I shouldn't discount that too much, but it wasn't the difference. You know, Bernie would have lost anyway under any possible way of voting, superdelegates, no superdelegates, whatever. But the caucus versus primary thing, I think, actually hurts the Bernie folks because of, you know, that's where they were particularly strong in this last cycle. Now, who knows what 2020 will look like, whether Bernie will even be in it, but whether or not Bernie's in it, you can almost guarantee there'll be a Bernie surrogate that is in the process. We'll see. So I don't know. In the end, when you add both of these two pieces together, I'm not sure who it benefits. Now, Yeah, and in terms of eliminating caucuses entirely, you have to, the state governments have to be involved in that too. The party can't just unilaterally decide that. So anyway, I thought all of that, the rule changes stuff, was interesting. It's been percolating ever since the 2016 election, and I've sort of been keeping track of it on the back burner. But this last week was when sort of the final package of rules was approved by the party, and this looks like what we're getting in 2020. So,
and of course, you have to keep track of that because that's part of your website, right? You got to be able to.
Yeah, and well, I will tell you that the if we have no superdelegates in 2020, it will make my life so much easier for the part of my process on electiongraphs.com where I'm tracking the delegate race, because actually just tracking, okay, who won how many delegates in the primaries and caucuses is relatively easy. The part that was a real pain in the ass was you've got these super delegates from all over the country that express their preferences, and maybe it gets into a news article, maybe it doesn't. And, you know, do they, and they can change their mind anytime they want. Tracking these people and their views, was relatively hard. Now, luckily, other people were doing it for me on Wikipedia. And so for the most part, I could like look at the list on Wikipedia and be like, oh, great, somebody else updated that. Awesome. But even with that, it was still a process. Like every day I'd go through the list saying, okay, are there any new superdelegates who expressed a preference since yesterday? And, or did anybody who's changed their mind, and flip the bit on those particular people. Whereas if it's just, okay, we had a primary, what were the results? I do that once. I don't have to check it every day to see if it's changed.
Yep.
So, yeah. So that, in terms of process, I said at the beginning, I sort of think that there's a good place for superdelegates because it adds more institutional inertia, which, you know, okay, I understand why some people are sometimes frustrated by institutional inertia, but I actually think there's a value in not changing too much too fast, and that provides sort of some breaks on the process. You know, I've said on the show and in other contexts, you know, the Republicans didn't have superdelegates. If they did, one of the mainstream candidates might have been able to stop Donald Trump, because he did not have institutional support in the party until the day he won the nomination, essentially. And if that had been, if there had been an institutional mechanism like superdelegates for those people to express their preference earlier on, they might have been able to, you know, rally around Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or somebody else in a more effective way than they were. Now, given the utter fear that they seemed to show through most of 2016, maybe that wouldn't have happened anyway, but it would have given a plausible mechanism for them to weigh in. And I think that would have been healthy. And so that ends up being a guard against some sort of populist figure rising up and sort of taking control all of a sudden.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
and we both saw that firsthand in 2012, and actually more so in 2008 on the Republican side with Ron Paul. You know, there was a big groundswell for him. He had a lot, you know, more people at his rallies and such. But because McCain and then later Mitt were the anointed candidates, they had the help of the party, and I saw how. The infighting in the party was, you know, they would set the rules here in this state to really hurt us. In fact, at the state convention in 2008, the McCain people did a walkout. It was so petty because it was already after we had chosen the delegates, and we were just trying to do some closing business, and they just walked out.
Hmm. Okay. Your turn.
Nothing else other than, how's that, smoke detector going?
It's still beeping. as I'm sure you've heard so far this episode. I did change one of the smoke detectors a while back that had a problem, but at this moment, one of the ones that has a problem is, again, the one that I need to like bring in the big ladder for, and so I just have not done it. And I think there's another one somewhere that's easier to reach, and I also just haven't done that, and I have no good excuse for that second one.
Now, be sure, when you do it, don't put a rechargeable battery in there.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I like the rechargeable batteries, but they clearly don't do the job well in the smoke detectors.
No, they're a different voltage level. They're lower level, and the smoke detector isn't designed for that.
Well, itself. And I've also noticed, even within that, I've got a handful of 9-volt batteries that I just picked up from the shelf next to me. And there is a wide range in what I have in front of me in terms of, I mean, they're all 9-volt, but they're in terms of the milliamp hours on these suckers. And some are much larger and some are much smaller. And if I was using the smaller one, well, no wonder it starts complaining again in a relatively short period of time. So anyway.
That's worth it. Splurge on the nice battery.
Splurge on a nice battery. Yeah, yeah. I should do that. Okay, so if that's all you have for me,
yep.
You've talked about how you're sad that I'm excluding all Republicans in the future, at least until major changes happen. I know mm-hmm. you identify as a libertarian and not as a Republican or a Democrat, but you've participated a lot in Republican politics locally in the past.
I have to admit that I'm more sympathetic to Republican views. At least Republicans are less hostile to libertarians mm-hmm. than Democrats are. So that's why I still participate.
So are you still participating in local Republican politics?
To tell you the truth, I don't really go to the meetings. When it comes to local issues, like talking to the local state reps and seeing what's going on there, I'm very much in line with the Republicans in this state. But when it comes to national issues, it just sickens me to be with those people because I'm an open borders person. I'm an anti-war person. And Republicans are bad on both of those. And those are two of my top issues. And so whenever they start talking about those things, I just want to leave the room or argue with them or whatever. And so, so that's the only thing that keeps me in there is the local stuff.
Yeah. And see, on local issues, I could probably go on all kinds of other directions because it all depends on what the local issue is. And it's very, it's a lot less ideological if you get really down to the nitty gritty of some local things. Now, obviously there's still some ideological element to it.
Yeah, like when it comes to tolls on a certain road or
right.
whether you want to have schools or what the zoning should be for this particular neighborhood. I love getting involved in that kind of stuff. So I've been really more involved in the local stuff.
Yeah. And see, where I come down on that is still like, well, you know, even if I agree with them on some local issue or this thing or that thing, you know, if they're going to the state house and voting with this side, it starts impacting all those national issues I care about. And, you know, and you can't really isolate the vote to that one thing. So I was just curious to see what your level of involvement is. Cause as you've said, you know, there are a lot of things you're disgusted by, which mm-hmm. sort of, but you know,
well, you know, it's funny, but well, you know, that I broke the law on the last presidential race. I
wasn't going to mention that, but okay, go ahead.
I'll go ahead. I'll admit it. Fine. I was a delegate for both the Republican and Democrat caucuses.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually planning on going to the Democrat County Convention, but I just kind of like didn't want to bother with it. But it would have been fun to, because I was for Bernie. When it comes to foreign policy stuff, yeah, Bernie was the closest thing. By the time it was just down to Bernie, Hillary, and Trump, I was like, well, I guess it's Bernie. So, but also on the other hand, I was still involved in the Republican caucus process too. And, I could have taken that level too.
Are you going to do both in 2020?
It really depends on the individuals. It really does. I mean, I've got certain key issues when it comes to the presidential level. It's like I said, it's the border issues and the foreign policy. It used to be Democrats were better when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to, peace and stuff, but that's not the case now. So it could go either way. I mean, you could end up with a hawk like Hillary running for the president, or you can end up with, even Obama. He campaigned on being anti-war, but then he did nothing while he was in office with regard to that. In fact, he made things worse. So it's really hard to tell.
Which I guess brings you to the question that you asked me offline beforehand on what do I think of the 2020 field on the Democratic side. And my honest answer there at this point is I really don't know. I have a better idea of what I don't want than what I do want. I don't want Hillary again. I don't want Sanders. I don't want Biden. You know, I feel like it's time to turn the page on all of that. And I think bringing of those three, I'd probably prefer Biden. But I don't really want any of those three. I want to see something fresh and something new. There are a lot of candidates out there that whose names are being talked about, but none of them are really grabbing me from my own personal point of view of, oh my God, I like them. I want them. And I haven't really spent a lot of time digging into the personal histories and the viewpoints and what would be different about candidate X versus candidate Y. We'll obviously start seeing a lot more of that in just a couple months. I'm racking my brains on how I'm going to, carve out the time to get everything ready to launch my electiongraphs.com stuff on the day after the midterms, which is my goal. It's 2 months away. Yeah. I have to find the time somewhere, to get things set up. But, after the midterms, we're going to be seeing a lot of that. We're going to have candidates coming out of the woodworks everywhere. There is not on the Democratic side an anointed one like there was with Hillary. Going back to 2008, I mean, it was clear very early on that the major players were Obama and Hillary. There were a few other people running, but you knew who the two biggies were, right? And we don't have a two or three big players right now. We've got like a dozen people whose names keep being tossed around, of various levels of, prominence. Oh, I know another one. I don't want Avenatti.
I've heard of that, who that is.
Oh, the Stormy Daniels lawyer. He's been going around Iowa and saying he's seriously considering running for president.
Crazy.
Because he knows how to take it to Donald Trump.
Well, one of the reasons I ask is just to point out that I think that Trump has it in the bag for 2020.
I think he does too. I think there you may get somebody like Kasich or somebody deciding to primary him, but it's not going to go anywhere. I think it's clear the Republican Party, certainly the part of the Republican Party that goes to Republican primaries and caucuses, is all in on Trump. Like, so if somebody, if Kasich...
It pains me to say that. I mean, I really do not want Trump as president. I really hate so many of the things. There's a few things that I like that he's doing, but I would love for there to be a nice, strong anti-war candidate, someone... like Bernie Sanders. I'd love to see him out there because even though I'm totally against his social stuff, I know that he won't be able to get any of it passed to Congress. All the good stuff that Bernie Sanders could do, he would be able to do with executive order. All the bad stuff that he wants to do, he would need Congress to do it. And I know Congress wouldn't do it. So that's why I'm okay with him.
Understood. But so I don't know. I would love to see a Republican challenger just to show that the Republicans still have that in them. But I feel like they would get squashed instantly.
No,
you know,
no
like
way.
It no one's going to. I mean, if Kasich is the one that's been talked about the most, I guess people have also talked about Flake, Senator Flake, potentially running.
Oh, yeah. He'd be really good.
Yeah. Both of these guys, like if they decided to run, I'd love to see them run, but they're not going to make it past Iowa and New Hampshire. They're going to get squashed, you know. Yeah,
but you know what? They may know that. But they're just kind of getting their foot in the door so that they're the next anointed one for the next one in line for 2024.
And the Republican Party used to work like that. Like whoever came in second, you know, would be the next nominee. But mm-hmm. I think that, you know, again, unless you have a situation where Donald Trump goes down in flames in a massive loss in 2020, or I suppose if you have an impeachment and scenario where the Republicans actually go along and get rid of him, which I don't think is likely. But unless you have a scenario where Donald Trump leaves office in total utter shame and electoral decimation, mm-hmm. unless you have that scenario, whoever's next after Donald Trump on the Republican side is going to look more like Donald Trump than sort of the Republican moderates of old.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have, you know, the second coming of Sarah Palin or something, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think it's more, the other thing I'd love to see happen is like McMullen or somebody running again, but getting in earlier, you know, to try to produce sort of a more reasonable
sort of
Republican alternative.
Token never Trumper.
Yeah. I mean, and again, I guess my theme on the never voting for Republicans again is at this point, the only Republicans that I respect are never Trumpers mm-hmm. and there are a few of them who are still sort of holding the torch that says, you know, at some point I want to reclaim my party. You know, and I don't know when or how that'll be, but I'm going to keep calling myself a Republican because at some point I want to bring back the Republicans as they used to be. I think that's a losing battle. I think if those people want to go anywhere at this point, they really have two choices. They either become Democrats or they start going into the wilderness of being a third party for a while. Because the Republican Party as it is now a Trump Party. And I think it's going to stay that way for the foreseeable future. And specifically by Trump Party, I don't just mean a cult of personality on Trump. I mean, they have sort of activated this sort of nativist, racist, yeah. You know, we, you know, want to go back to the good old, you know, white people days of the 1950s.
Yes, where, I know. And that has always been there. Since I've been involved for the last 10 years in the Republican Party, those are the type of people that have been at these meetings, and it just sickens me because they're not overtly racist, but they are.
This is why, you know, I attended a couple of I went to these at the time in the 2012 cycle, like you were mentioning, and I had to stop because of that. I felt every time I went to one of these meetings, I felt like I was an invader there because I looked around and saw the kind of behavior that you're talking about. And I was disgusted by it. And I'm like, you know, okay, even if I can agree with some of the things that you're talking about policy wise, the whole sort of visceral attitude that's pervasive here is something that makes me uncomfortable to the core. And I can't be a part of that.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that you're right. It's always been there, or at least since the, you know, since the racist whites fled the Democratic Party in the 1960s, it's been there at the very least. But I think it is rapidly accelerated, and that faction has gained.
And they're all there and saying, hey, see, we're right all along. And yep. Look how wonderful he's doing. And I'm seeing former Ron Paul people who are just all elated with Trump and like, my dad is like totally in love with him. And my, my dad's like a Rush Limbaugh listening Republican, and lives in North Carolina. And we can't talk politics at all, because it just, we can't agree on anything.
Yeah, but I think that part of the party has taken over it, and I don't see it being taken back. I see that my prediction is that you know, because, you know, of sort of that, because that part of the party really is a minority. It's really like 30-40% of the population at most. They're enabled by the structure of the Senate and the Electoral College. But they just barely won this time around. And I feel like they could win again in 2020, but it would take
them. Exactly. And yet it's crazy. How is it that we have a system where someone so unpopular, he's got a shoo-in to win because the Democrats can't get their act together. Well, they don't have a national figure.
That's what I was going to say, is that like they're, The Democrats should have had it in the bag in 2016. Like, the fact that Donald Trump was able to pull it out for any number of factors is somewhat insane. But even looking forward to 2020, it really depends who the Democrats nominate. The Democrats could easily fuck this up and lose again. You know, it is.
The Democrats picked the only person on the planet who would lose to Donald Trump. The only person in America less popular than Donald Trump was Hillary Clinton.
Pretty much. And that might not have been fair, but it was true.
And I know that Yvonne is going to be hearing that, and he's going to be yelling at this recording. But
well, no,
it's true.
I mean, we talked about during the election. I mean, you know, it actually went in both directions. I mean, we felt like, you know, the Republicans could have nominated anybody else and easily won against Hillary Clinton, not just by a squeaker. And the Democrats could have nominated anybody else and easily beat Donald Trump. At least it seems that way, you know, because they were both so crazy unpopular. But the Democrats have a real knack for screwing things up, and I have no doubt that they could screw things up in 2022. 2020 also, not 2022. Yeah. but, you know, we'll see, though. I mean, Donald Trump is not doing himself any favors, but there, you know, there's plenty there. I mean, you know.
Yes, there's so much there, but the there, you can't tack it down, because it's the news cycle. It's every week. It's a scandal a week for the last, 3 years?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's all stuff that if you picked one and hammered on it completely day in, day out, maybe you'd gain some traction at some point. But with it cycling so fast, nothing ever really gains ground. But even then, like we were saying with the polarization, people have picked their sides. And the people who support Donald Trump, even if they don't like some of what he does, have made their peace with it and said, hey, as long as I get X, Y, and Z, I'm cool. I don't care what else he does.
Yep. And one of the things that I'm happy with is his Supreme Court nomination. So
I knew you would be.
Yes. I especially happy with Gorsuch. Kavanaugh. He could have picked someone better, but
He's got some executive power stuff in his background that I think you would be uncomfortable with.
Yes, exactly. That's and the Fourth Amendment stuff, you know, the government monitoring, he's been in favor of that. And
Okay. Well, I think we've reached about the end here, unless you have some other topics you want to bring up to finish it up. Thanks for joining us, Bruce. I really do appreciate talking to you again after a while, and hopefully it won't be quite as long before we have you on again. As we do get into the 2020 cycle, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about all of this stuff as it gels a bit. But I predict it's going to be a very, very chaotic cycle, because the Democrats will be all over the place with, you know, a dozen or more candidates fighting it out, and sort of this the Bernie versus Clinton, moderate versus progressive battle continuing to play out. And on the Republicans' side, we're not necessarily going to have, you know, a serious primary challenge as we discussed, but I think we're going to continue to have Trump drama, you know, as long as he is president. I don't see it possible that that sort of at any point becomes calm.
But no impeachment. I'll just put that out right now. No way he's going to get impeached.
Do you think no conviction, or do you think the Democrats won't even do the impeachment?
I think the Democrats are probably smart enough that knowing that he can't get a conviction in the Senate won't even do the impeachment, and even if they take control of the House.
Yeah, and this ties to what Yvonne and I have been saying, that I think, well, Yvonne started to change his mind, but I don't think it serves a great purpose unless you have enough Republicans in the Senate going along with you that you could convict. Otherwise, it's a pointless exercise, it seems to me.
Yeah. And it just tears up the country, and then people be even more mad at the Democrats for putting us through that.
Yeah, but, you know, who knows what the next 2 years will bring. And if anything, as I've said on the Republican side as well, I'm not predicting that the Republicans flip on Donald Trump, but if they ever do, it will happen quickly because it'll be like a dam bursting.
People have tried, like Blake, but doesn't seem to have any traction there.
Okay. That's it. Thank you for joining us for yet another Curmudgeon's Corner. The usual. I'm at AbelSmay on Twitter. Bruce, what are you on Twitter?
At BYU Fan.
And you can join our Curmudgeon's Corner Slack. Either, you know, contribute to the show by co-hosting like Bruce has just done, or by sending us lots of comments all the time, or by actually contributing money. Go to patreon.com/curmudgeonscorner and you can toss us a buck or two as a tip, and we appreciate that, and we'll let you on the Slack. And for even more, you can get a mug. And by the way, Bruce, you've co-hosted enough. You should get a mug. So send me that. Send me your address after the show, and I'll send you a mug.
Wow. Wow. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. I'll pay for it anyway.
You don't have to. So that's it. I think that – did I forget anything that I usually say at the end of the show, Bruce? I got all confusticated there.
No, that's pretty much it.
Okay. Well, hey, everybody have a good week. Have a good Labor Day weekend. I'm going on a 4-day weekend with my family to a camp without internet. And so that'll be fun. I hope all of you have something interesting to do then, and have a good time and a good weekend. And we'll see you all next week with whatever's in the news next time. Goodbye.
Bye.